And now, the Low Post.
Welcome to a Wednesday edition of the Low Post podcast, where we have had 4 to 5 relative days of NBA tranquility since the Russell Westbrook, Chris Paul mega trade. And we've reached a point where we can sort of sit back, zoom out, remember like what team Myers Leonard plays for, and figure out what in the hell just happened and what might happen next season and what it all means and what player empowerment has done to the league and this and that. And I can't think of anyone better to bat some of those ideas around than my friend Kevin Arnovitz. Mr. Arnovitz, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Always appreciate the well and not the good. It's correct. It makes me think of my father. And I forgot that you said that until right now.
I'm both good and well.
Okay. All right, that's good. That's good to hear. It's a nice time of year. NBA is finally slowing down. Maybe we get a Chris Paul trade soon. Maybe we don't. But boy, what a couple of weeks, huh? Did you enjoy it?
I don't know. I mean, the intrigue is there. I do think it's still, and maybe this is generational, I'm just still trying to grapple with a league where the transactions excite people clearly more than even the most important games. Like, I don't recall this intensity during the finals at all, and maybe that was the KD injury, maybe that was, who knows, but I'm still just trying to make sense of that. I don't mind it. It just still, like, there's this, I remember, like, David Axelrod, the political commentator who was Obama's guy, he was on one of those CNN panels, I think the night of, like, New Hampshire or Iowa in 2016, and I remember this, like, kind of funny, ironic moment he said where, you know, now they had results for the first time, or maybe it was Iowa. So it was like, we've been following the polling for like, you know, months and months and months, well over a year. And now there were these like hard results that mattered and produced delegates. I remember him saying like, yeah, can we stop talking about the results and get back to talking about the polls? Right. And it was just, it struck me as amusing because it was just like, exactly like, why should we talk about the games and the championships and actually the wins and losses? We can talk about the machinations that will lead up to the next set of wins and championships and wins and losses. And it is still, I don't know if it's good for the league or bad for the league, right? I mean, the general view is, hey, you're talking about the NBA in July when there aren't even games on. But I also think, you know, and Adam Silver said this to Bill Simmons, you know, in his March conversation, at some point it doesn't matter what they're talking about, right? And it is, I think, strange that, like, I meet more and more people who never actually watch any games except maybe they'll catch a Friday night late game or something when they get home. But we'll follow the league on Twitter. Like, the league is winning Twitter, and ratings are kind of down. And I just don't know what that means other than, it's a whole lot of fun to watch these bidding wars and these, you know, this expanded market now where every team, even if you don't have cap space, is a candidate because you can use a sign and trade, and agents have been really good at kind of expanding the marketplace of teams, even those that don't have the space. But I mean, are we all going to hell is the question, right? Like,
I did a podcast. It must be 4 years ago. I don't know when this podcast started. I don't know when this was, but I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, if that's even possible, with Will Leach of all people, who I've actually met for maybe 8 seconds combined in my whole life, because he wrote a piece way back then about, does it matter that people don't seem to care about like the actual game of basketball nearly as much as they care about trades and free agency? Like, is that some sort of existential crisis for the NBA? And that was 5 years ago, and it's only gone that way to an even greater extreme in the interim, peaking with the 6 hours on June 30th and July 1st, and really 7 hours since the Nets stuff was done before it even started, where it seemingly half the league was made over in that span of time. And it was crazy, and everyone is talking about it. And maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe what we're feeling as fans of basketball, the game, is actually not what's happening. Maybe all those people who are obsessed with transactions are equally obsessed with the game, and the TV ratings decline is misleading or temporary or whatever. But I will say, I know in the Board of Governors in Vegas last week, this subject, among many, many others, came up, and a couple of the owners said, hey, look, it's great everyone's talking about the league. It's great that Major League Baseball is having its all-star game like tonight or whenever this was, and no one cares and no one's talking about the selections. But let's just keep an eye on it. Let's keep an eye on this is not me. This is owner saying this. Let's keep an eye on the TV ratings. Let's see what happens. Let's see if there's a penalty for A, fans preferring the transaction game to the game, because the transaction game, although it now exists in a sort of permanent state of rumoring, is really centered around three or four dates on the calendar and the 48 hours following them and preceding them. And the games are, there's a million of them. So theoretically that should matter. And let's see what it does to fans who, let's see if there is a consequence to fans sort of feeling like, well, boy, I remember a time when I like the Warriors staying together for 5, 6, 7, 8. I mean, how many years of Steph and Draymond and Klay have played together for 6, 7, 8 years now? Is that an anomaly now? Are the Showtime Lakers, where the core was together for 11 years, is that just not even possible? Is there any penalty you pay in fan support for that? Or do fans just consume the game in a totally different way and it doesn't matter? All of these questions were asked. Nobody knows the answers, but I feel like a geezer like you, kind of walking around locker rooms like, does anyone care about the game? Like, this is the finals. Anyone care about the finals? Like what's actually happening or no?
Yeah, I mean, there are two things. So one is, like, as you just said, I acknowledge that for eons, older people have been kvetching about the state of their sports leagues and the way that the younger people consume them. So, like, I totally recognize there's nothing really new. It's part of the life cycle of any league. But like you, you know, kind of talking to people in Vegas, and in the story I reported a couple of weeks ago on the league's interest in shortening the schedule, or not shortening the schedule, but actually reducing the number of games, is when you talk to business ops people and both people inside the league, there is, I think, a sense that how sanguine they were 3 years ago when, hey, we're the league that's the darling of social media. We are kicking the asses of the other sports, that those days are over, that no one is just sort of celebrating anymore the idea that this is the sexy, cool kids league that is followed even when the games aren't on. And I think there is now a real concern that, you know, whether it's the fact that nobody under the age of 30 has cable television anymore, you know, who knows what the future of that income stream of local broadcast revenue, that there is a reckoning that's coming. And it is a business story, and the league is concerned because, again, the whole point of chatter is that it generates interest. You talk about the movie before it comes out because you're going to rush to the theater on Friday and Saturday night, you know, to watch it in the opening weekend. And if you get to a point where the chatter is the end and not the means, you get to a point where, okay, how many 28-year-olds who love pontificating or speculating about where Kawhi might go are actually going to buy a seat to an NBA arena or are actually going to have a cable or DirecTV subscription and watch the game? And are they actually going to buy League Pass? And at the end of the day, if you can't monetize the person who's whittling away their lunch hour, kind of refreshing the newsbreaker's feeds, then that's not an end, right? That's noise.
Well, that's where things like the League Pass Red Zone thing, whatever the heck that is, like where you can get the crunch time of whatever games are going on that night. Like that's a smart idea. That's a way to thread the needle of, all right, I'm someone who sort of has the game on in the background and I'm on Twitter and I'm talking to my spouse and I'm not like sitting there like, what's the pick and roll coverage? What's the rotation? Oh my God, he tweaked the second quarter rotation. What does this mean going forward? But I do like basketball. I want to see it when it matters. Like that's a smart idea. I bet that will be very, very popular if and when that happens. And I can't remember what the timetable on that is, but that's a good idea.
No, I'm optimistic. I mean, one thing I like about the NBA and admire about the NBA is I think they tend to be really resourceful at coming up with responses, but this does require a response, right? Like you at some point you have to monetize the interest. And it can't be done on free outlets. I mean, that stuff is supposed to drive people to then spend the money to get the Red Zone or the fourth quarter or whatever it is, or to go to the arena or to buy the big package. And look, I mean, you might be able to find, you know, tens of millions of new viewers in overseas to the point where the American, you know, the obsessions of the American millennial don't really matter anymore or matter in the far lower numbers. But I do think like you, as I talk to people, especially in the business ops area, that they do recognize this is a challenge. that there is a reckoning coming. And this in and of itself is no longer this, hey, we're the darlings of social media. Nobody cares anymore, right? Like it does, as Adam said in March, it does matter what they're talking about. But I think even more what they're talking about, it matters what they do. And you have to do. I mean, at some point you have to tune in. You have to watch on Fox Sports, Mars, whatever, you know, or whatever the new, you know, the new Sinclair entity will be. You have to actually tune in on a Tuesday night to watch the Magic and the Hornets. And I do think that is, because that's the product. At the end of the day, that is the product.
Speaking of Fox Sports Mars, can we just take 30 seconds to appreciate the career of Steve Buckhantz, who is not coming back as the Wizards play-by-play announcer after I don't know how many years, many years.
Oh.
Yeah, they announced that some new guy's taking over. I'm sure the new guy will be great. And this happens like whenever there's a you know when your favorite website changes and everyone is like instantly outraged by the format? Oh, it just sucks. I hate
still
this.
Miss the ESPN carousels.
But then a week later, everyone's like, oh, for the most part, some changes are actually just bad. But a week later, everyone's like, oh, this makes sense, and now I'm used to it, and I kind of like my new Gmail. I kind of like my new whatever. So the new guy, I'm sure, will be great, and everything moves on. But Steve Buckhantz, man, nobody did misery. Nobody channeled the fans' misery of a perpetually bad team better than Steve Buckhantz. No one sighed like him. No one used 9 second exasperated silences after a JaVale McGee turnover or something better than Steve Buckhantz to articulate what every diehard Wizards fan was feeling at that moment. I've written this many times. I honestly thought that during some games he was just going to start drinking, or that there would be a 20 or that there would just be a 20 second silence and Phil Chenier would just say, ladies and gentlemen, Steve Buckhantz has taken his suitcase and is on the way to the airport, and we would just never hear from him again. He'd go to Hawaii and buy it. Goodbye. Farewell, Steve Buckhantz. I'm excited to see what, if anything, is happening next. You are a legend. And, even though the new guys will probably be very good, no one will ever articulate Wizards fandom like Steve Buckhantz did.
No, it's absolutely true, and it is an underrated. Now that so many of the local broadcasts are connected to the team, there's less of that. But like, having grown up a 1980s Braves fan before they got good, like Skip Carey was really good at that. Like, I specifically remember him telling you to go walk the dog, you know, when it got to like the bottom of the sixth and the Braves were down 11-1. Yeah, time to walk the dog. You know, there's something about a broadcaster conveying the absolute just gut-wrenching misery of a beleaguered fan of a terrible team. And you just don't hear anymore because, again, these guys are now generally in the employ, and they're wonderful at their jobs, but they're in the employ of their owner.
There was one game this season against Phoenix, and I put it in a 10 things column about an item about Buck, where I think there was 26 consecutive seconds of silence after like a Wizards turnover and then a Phoenix basket, and then literally, he's just silent the entire time, and then there's a timeout, and he just says, "Timeout, Wizards. Lead is down to 3," or something like that. It was just an absolute. No other broadcaster working in the NBA right now would have or could have done that. So, hats off, Steve Buckhantz. Let's talk about another reckoning. Speaking of reckonings that are happening, I want to take a second and do this with you because you are more than almost anyone I know well positioned to have this discussion amidst all of this craziness, right? Okay, let's step back for a second. Chris Paul is now on the Thunder, and the Thunder, I think, would like to trade Chris Paul, have not been able to do so yet. Maybe they're not ever going to be able to do so. I don't know. So Chris Paul at age 34 is just now on the Thunder, and this is a player who has been talked about, been the point god. He's been talked about as, I don't know, a top 3, 4, 5 point guard of all time. He's been mentioned in the same breath of Magic Johnson, despite the 5-0 championships edge that Magic Johnson has over him. He famously had never made the conference finals until the Rockets made the conference finals in his first season there, and he gets hurt in Game 5, at the end of Game 5, in a series in which Houston leads 3-2 after that game and loses the last two games in somewhat wild and crazy fashion. Then this year ends in dispiriting fashion, against the Durantless Warriors for the last six quarters of the series. And then you have all the coaches are let go, and rumors of a Chris Paul trade demand that Daryl Morey denies publicly, that Chris Paul denies publicly. Like, they put their names to it. So you can say, oh, they're lying. This is what, maybe they're lying. Maybe this is, they're just spinning. This is what officials do. But you know what? They put their names to it. They didn't do it anonymously. They didn't leak it. They got on the phone and said, yes, I, Daryl Morey, say it's emphatically wrong that Chris Paul demanded a trade. Puts his name to it. So whatever, if he puts his name to it, it's news. So that happened. But the rumors of, they don't like each other, they're sick of playing with each other, there was confrontations in game six as their season was slipping away about James Harden dominating the ball and Chris wants more movement and yada, yada, yada. And then bam, Chris Paul is gone. And now he's on the Thunder. And so I leave this to you. Now, he still has years left in the league. He's still a very good player. Maybe he gets rerouted to a good team and has a chance to continue writing his postseason legacy. Maybe he doesn't. So we can go through all the postseason history of Chris Paul and relitigate it and talk about it and all of this. If we assume that the Clippers thing ran its course and there were hard feelings at the end of that, the Rockets thing ran its course and there were hard feelings at the end of that, and now Chris Paul's just on Oklahoma City and maybe never makes the playoffs again in his career. Where is he? In the history of the game, what is Chris Paul's legacy? Like, how do we reckon with this? If this is the end of relevant postseason Chris Paul, and maybe it is and maybe it isn't, where does that leave us?
So you wrote this piece, and I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago. And it was about Chris Paul, but it wasn't about Chris Paul, right? And it was, I forget sort of the frame you used, but generally speaking, it was, you know, sort of in some ways, Chris Paul is the great place to have a conversation of how we even appraise anybody, right? And I think you called it like the broken criteria for success, or the broken, you know, the way that we look at a player's legacy is just completely broken. And, you know, and now, by the way, what's interesting is not much has changed other than, you know, Chris got to advance to a conference final. And I think you and I kind of have similar ideas, which is it's hard for me. On one hand, it's really hard to hold a player completely responsible for the level of advancement he's made in the postseason. Yet on the other hand, I think it's also fair to say that the very, very greatest, at some point, you know, summon whatever they summon or find themselves on championship teams or on that podium. And then there are exceptions to this. I mean, Dirk Nowitzki is an interesting case, right? Because he won an NBA Finals, but I wouldn't say that was fluky. There's sort of a constellation of events that got him there. Would we think about Dirk differently if he didn't win in 2011? But I look at Chris Paul, like I just ran a query, you know, because you sent me this earlier, and since 2010, league leaders in win shares for 48. And this wasn't, by the way, this is the first stat I actually put in, because actually win shares tend to favor big men. LeBron James and Chris Paul are tied for number one. Win shares for 48 minutes over the last, what, 9 seasons of the NBA. And yeah, that might be an arbitrary endpoint, but this was the first query I ran. I mean, number 3 is Kevin Durant. Number 4 is James Harden. Number 5 is Kawhi Leonard. And, I mean, that's astounding. His achievements as a point guard are astounding. Even those who have not enjoyed playing with him will tell you just the level of confidence a team can proceed into a basketball possession, which is what we're doing here, right? I mean, we are scoring points within 24 seconds. But having that nod, he is great. But I also think he also brings up a really interesting question, which is there a difference between an amazing floor general and an amazing leader? Because I think by all accounts, Chris Paul is the best floor general of his generation. You know, I think we often, in those when we talk about him, make sort of the immediate jump to Chris Paul's a great leader. And what I think we found is that he's not a great leader. And I don't mean that as any expression of hate or anything else. Like, I just think that leadership's one of those really interesting things. And again, I don't even know how to quantify. I don't know if that matters. Does it matter if a guy is a great leader? I mean, I think by most criteria, we say, yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, that is what, you know, LeBron, for all the chaos that might swirl, is a great leader. I mean, but, you know, Chris is kind of problematic that way. And it is born out of, in some ways, his very competence. I mean, the guy is often right. Like all of these beefs that we're hearing behind the scenes at Houston, he wanted more movement. Well, he's kind of right. Like, there are probably ways the Houston Rockets could better leverage their talent in big postseason situations than what they're currently doing. That seems to be one of Chris's points of view, and he's right. He's not always right. And it is interesting. I mean, you've been part of wedding parties, and this is kind of the dynamic that's been explained to me over the years. Is if you've been a part of a wedding party like I have, every once in a while you'll run into the wedding planner. And you know the sort of corporal wedding planner we're talking about. Like, this is an event. It has to be produced, right? People have to walk down the aisle and in order, and there's an event. It has to go on time, and someone's got to get the wine glasses out of the way between the cocktail, all the other stuff. It's like you need this person. But at the end, part of it, it is still supposed to be a joyous event. And I have been part of weddings where there's a moment where, you know, you sort of look at one of the other groomsmen and say, like, isn't this supposed to be fun? Because the wedding planner is just, there's a reign of terror and officiousness and bossiness. And it's sort of the kind of that is, yet, by the way, without this wedding planner, the event would be an absolute choreographed disaster. But at some point, that person's kind of officiousness does subvert the overall vibe of the day, which is kind of supposed to be joyous and fun, and everyone is really supposed to enjoy this. And I do think that there is a little bit of that, and I do it is sort of now gotten to a point where it is clear that many of Chris's coworkers don't enjoy working with him that much as they absolutely uniformly admire his genius, and he is a genius. I don't know how we appraise that. I mean, what's our current line on guys who don't win championships? In some ways, you know, Russ is another place to go with this, right? For totally different reasons, right? Russ is almost the mirror image, or mirror, actually kind of the other side of Chris. I mean, but, you know, what is our current position on how great is a guy if he's never won a title? I don't know the answer to that question right now. LeBron's won, Kawhi's won, Dwayne retired one. I'm kind of going through sort of the roster of greats. You know, obviously Steph and KD, but I don't know how we're doing that. Can you update your 2015 or 14 piece? And, like, where are we on the broken narrative of success?
So I wrote that in 2014, and the very next year, the following things happened to Chris Paul. Hits a almost literal Game 7 walk-off buzzer beater to beat San Antonio in one of the greatest first-round series of all time. Like, unless you're Damian Lillard or Michael Jordan shooting over Craig Elo, you can't get a more clutch shot than that. And, of course, it happened in the first round. And I think a continual theme of Chris's career, which we'll go into, is that he has great – his overall postseason stats, which I'll recite to you in a second, are incredible. And he has unbelievable postseason moments. Almost – they tend to happen in the first and second round. And so in the second round of that same playoffs is when they melt down against the Rockets in Game 6 and blow a 19-point lead at home, end up losing by 12. They lose the fourth quarter 40-15. In that meltdown of Game 6, Chris Paul has 31-11-7 on 10 of 19 shooting. So pretty hard to argue that's his fault. Matt Barnes, 4 of 12. DeAndre Jordan, 2 of 5. J.J. Redick, 4 of 13. Jamal Crawford, 4 of 13. Glenn Big Baby Davis playing fourth quarter minutes in that game because the Clippers were so thin and poorly built by GM coach Doc Rivers. Yet, Chris Paul in the fourth quarter, 2 of 7. Blake Griffin in the fourth quarter, 0 of 5, and missed a lot of bunnies in that game. So here are some Chris Paul stats. You ready? As we appraise his career, there are only five players in the history of the NBA who have averaged 18 points and 9 assists per game. You know, again, and Chris is at about 19 and 10 if you round up both. Oscar Robertson, Magic Johnson, Isaiah Thomas, Chris Paul, and John Wall. Chris Paul is the only player in the history of the NBA to average 18 and 9 and make over 1,000 threes. Obviously, his era has a lot to do with that. Oscar Robertson did not have the luxury of getting to make.
What did Stockton average per game?
Not 18. I'm going to guess it was.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
I'll look it up right now, but I'm gonna guess. I'm literally typing in John Stockton. I'm going to guess his career average is 13.8. 13.1.
Wow.
Chris Paul playoff career averages are something like 29-5, 20 points, 9 assists, 5 boards on 48% and 37% shooting. His playoff player efficiency rating is 24.5. It's the sixth highest ever for any player. On a macro level, He is absolutely unassailable. Unassailable. None of these losses are his fault, or very few of these losses that torpedo his career are his fault, except he just,
the
like,
OKC.
The OKC one in 2014 where they blow that game five in Oklahoma City. Well, I mean, look, the Warriors.
Well, I'm not suggesting he's never had a bad game, but I think, like, if you wanted to, you know, charge him with a joke, God forbid. You know, like, I that's the only one I can really, I mean, to your point, he's just been incredibly good in incredibly big games.
People have long forgotten these Memphis Clippers bloodbath series from 2012 and 2013. He had some monster, like, I'm talking like four jumpers in a row over Tony Allen in crunch time. Kind of fourth quarters, but nobody cares because they happen in the first round. And I actually don't think that's unfair. I mean, the first round is not where legends are made, right? The conference finals and the finals are where legends are made. And he's just been like in the 2018 conference finals, he was okay against the Warriors. Just okay. And I believe he was 6 of 19 in game five before he got hurt. And then you go through, so the Rockets series happens again. He has 31-11-7. A bad fourth quarter, fine, happens. Maybe that's all you care about. But he did have 31-11-7, and the rest of the team other than Blake was terrible. In game seven, he had 26-10 on 9 of 20 shooting, and they lost. Okay? I mean, I'd have to go rewatch the game to see if that stat line is somehow misleading about Chris Paul's performance. 2016 is when they both, Blake and CP, get hurt. They lose to the Blazers. Who cares? 2017 is when they go out with a limp against Utah and lose game seven at home, and it was just
Blake,
like,
is out for most of that series.
Blake is out for a lot of that series, but that's still was a bad one. And again, he's had great moments, like 2000, his first Rockets year, second round against Utah, he goes for 41 to close out the Jazz in the second round. I mean, again, do you care about 41 against the like an okay Utah Jazz team in the second round? Maybe you don't. Like, and this is the story of Chris Paul's postseason career, is because his teams haven't regularly advanced to the final two rounds, a lot of his great moments, and they're legitimately great, are going to leave the fans who are predisposed to knock him down in history to just say, well, you know, it's against Utah in the second round. It's against Memphis in the first round. Like, why do we care? It's really interesting because he's been a part of a couple of high profile meltdowns and I actually, in preparation for this, I went back and rewatched the fourth quarter, that Houston Clippers fourth quarter from 2015, because I do think it's one of the seminal, what in the hell just happened? Like, the Clippers they had just beaten the defending champion Spurs. Remember how good that series was?
It was a fantastic series. I actually had to rewatch that game five, the meltdown, for a feature I did on kind of the Clippers' last stand a couple of years ago.
What do you remember?
To watch.
I only watched the game five. They lose in Houston, and everyone just kind of shrugged their shoulders, like, "Oh, that's the."
Oh, no, I mean, whatever that was, game six. I'm sorry.
What do you remember about it? Because I just watched the fourth quarter, and it was amazing to go back and rewatch it and be like, "Man, Glenn Davis is on the floor for like an extended period of time,
like a missed." Dunk by DeAndre, like,
yes.
Shots Blake never doesn't finish. Like, the interesting thing is just, and by the way, what was so odd about it is it wasn't like you couldn't do the Yakety Sax theme song. Everybody just kind of blew, like, this was ridiculous. It was just, and by the way, you know what else I remember? The two of the three worst three-point shooters of all time going absolute. Just
Josh Smith
bonkers.
Making step backs like in people's faces, and Josh Smith, has he been in the NBA Josh. Since that series? Since
no,
that playoffs?
One of the three were. I mean, Corey Brewer. Just again, I think these guys are two of the three lowest percentage 3-point shooters in the history of the game with X attempts. It was just. I mean, I remember talking to JJ Redick about that game, and his quote, which I think I included, was like, I mean, he's been. He still thinks about that game because it is just
they all
it,
do.
It,
it ruined their team.
They never recovered
from that game. They never ever
did.
Spiritually recovered from that game. I don't
think
they ever did.
Sports happens. That was sort of his quote. It was just like, it is one of those, the most bizarre confluence of events you'll ever see on a basketball court. Like, the highest percentage shots of all time. DeAndre Jordan, who, by the way, is effective field goal percentage. I mean, by and large, the guy doesn't take shots outside of a certain range, and he makes an incredible, he makes the ones at close range at an incredible rate, like missing dunks, Blake's bunnies. And then on the other side, you got these two guys who are just atrocious three-point shooters, going Dale Ellis and Ray Allen. And it was Daryl Morey had walked out of the arena in Los Angeles out of state. He couldn't stand it any longer. And he left after the third quarter to take laps around Staples Center just to brood about how his team got up, you know, essentially was about to get upset by the Los Angeles Clippers in a year they thought they had a real shot at the title. And it's one of the greatest, like, just bizarro quarters of basketball you'll ever see at high stakes.
And they lose, and again, he's 2 of 7 in the fourth quarter. And you would, when you rewatch that quarter, what strikes you is that, like, this, it's not rocket science, right? This has been the thing about evaluating Chris Paul is he's 6 feet tall. That's it. He may not, I don't know, I've stood next to him, I can't remember what, I'm 5'11 and 3/4, and I felt like we were about equal. Like, Kemba Walker's not 6 feet tall. Whatever he's listed, he's not that. And so you watch that game, and, like, Chris just can't, against a lot of defenders, he did it against Tony Allen once in a while, where he would just go one-on-one and score over him in some of those playoff series. But by 2015, he's completely dependent on the team game. And it's interesting that he's gone the other way in Houston, or he went the other way in Houston and went and became an ISO player, mostly against switches. But still, he's completely dependent on the team game. He's dependent on Blake Griffin making floaters and layups when they double Chris on the pick and roll and he slips him the pass. He's just, because of his height, he is just not able to commandeer the game in the way that the classic big wing players, and this is going to be relevant for a team we're going to discuss later, your Kawhis and your LeBrons and your KDs, are able to do by themselves and draw two guys at the elbow and draw two guys in the paint. That's just not what he's able to do in big moments. And maybe, you know, there is something to the fact that very few championship teams have a point guard as the best player on the team. And one of the exceptions is the Warriors pre-KD or with KD, whatever. I don't know how you want to rank those two. KD was the finals MVP twice, not Steph. One of the exceptions is literally an unprecedented three-point shooter who can bend the game in ways that no one ever has bent the game before or since. Maybe there's something to that, but it's going to just be fascinating to step back and look at his career, because he's had unbelievable games. You know, that Utah series that they lost, that dispiriting series that was the end of the Clippers, he's 6 of 19 in Game 7. And you can go and cherry pick these games that everyone has, and I've cherry picked some of the great ones and some of the bad ones. It's just, this is the overall postseason resume is one of consistent excellence, with a few high profile meltdowns that happened to occur in the later rounds in terms of where he advanced in the playoffs, and so they are magnified, I think, justifiably compared to some of the postseason heroics. But the overall resume is what it is, and it's just going to be, if he never wins at a high level again, where he ends up ranking with the Isaiah Thomases and Magics and Stocktons, it's going to be fascinating, because there are people in the league now who will still say Chris Paul is one of the three greatest point guards of all time. I don't care if he ever wins again, and that's going to be an uphill, right. that argument's going to be an uphill battle for some people.
I think they're right. I mean, And again, this is an interesting exercise, because the question is, like, how much does randomness count for anything? I mean, let's say he's done in New Orleans, and I'm just throwing a team out there, right? Like, and instead of the Clippers, actually, the Spurs are able to, and this isn't about, like, Spurs love or anything, I'm just using another team that sort of, you know, the Spurs hadn't won in about 4 or 5 years. I think we all, at that point, were sort of, they had stabilized, but they were no longer sort of, and he gets his way there, and they trade Chris for Tony Parker and who knows what else. I mean, I'm just wondering, like, like, and I'm not suggesting that he didn't have the talent with the Clippers to win. Though, by the way, that most years, I mean, yes, against Utah, I think they were the 4 and Utah was the 5. It isn't as if the Clippers didn't justify their seed.
There was also a famously vetoed trade to another Los Angeles team.
Well, there was that, too. Like, I'm wondering if that happened. So I don't know that that necessarily would have. I mean, who knows? I mean, let's say that. Let's say that. Let's say that they'd waved him in. That the Hornets or Pelican, whoever they were at the time, had an owner that was alive, and David Stern didn't exercise that authority and ends up with the Lakers, right? With Pau Gasol. I mean, would we have a different conversation about him? Oh yeah, he won, but he was a ring chaser. Like, I just think that I don't know how much to hold a guy's surrounding roster. In baseball, we don't do it very often. We don't play that game largely because I think we've all accepted that it's an individual sport masquerading as a team sport. So how can you fault a guy who's pitching, you know, for the 9 guys who are batting when he's not even on the, you know, on the field, right? Like, so I have a hard time holding Chris responsible for that, unless, going back to sort of my critique, which is you think there may be something endemic to his personality that's why you don't see it in the great stat lines and everything else, that there's just sort of there's just a general vibe or gestalt around the team he's on that just prevents it from being the greatest, because there's always a little bit of atmosphere. There's always a little bit of rancor. Like, the team always seems to be, you know, this didn't happen in New Orleans necessarily, but really since he got to Los Angeles,
yeah,
always a little discontent.
That's the team I want to go back and take a look at, because, you know, Lee Jenkins, before he became Clippers employee Lee Jenkins, free agency mastermind Lee Jenkins, wrote this story about Chris in Houston and how Chris has been chasing the 2008 Pelicans, chasing that vibe for every year since then, trying to find a team that was that together and that hungry and that united in its goal and that fun, like that, like, let's go bowling together and have fun. Since that team that lost to the Spurs in game 7 of the second round of the playoffs, a series in which Chris was phenomenal, in a year in which a lot of people thought he should have been the MVP of the whole league. I don't know if a lot of people thought that, but he was in the highest echelons of that conversation. And they lose to the Spurs in game 7. I think he had 18 and 14 in that game. He had a good, not great, but good, again, not good enough to carry them across the finish line, but a very good game. And they were so united and hungry in Houston that first year. And to go from that and 60 whatever wins to it all falls apart so fast is very, very strange. And I wonder, I said this on Simmons' podcast the other day, I wonder a couple things. Number one, was the James-Chris relationship that bad by the end? Did it all go down in flames because of the super-duper predictable issues between two ball-dominant players who maybe sought somewhat different things from the offense? And number two, and this is a good what-if that there's no way to answer it, what happens if KD doesn't get hurt and they just lose to the Warriors? And they're like, and remember, this is the only team, period, that pushed the Warriors with Durant. The only one. They ran roughshod over the entire league except for the Rockets. And 7 games 1 year, 6 games the following year. And you just wonder if losing to the Warriors without Durant, losing game 6 at home, when the entire NBA media story is, well, here's the opening. Here's the opportunity. Here's the once-in-a-lifetime break that you play for. Kevin Durant, who is literally scorching the entire playoffs, putting up 40 games and 50-point games, destroying everyone in his path, winning the argument to best player alive at that very moment, is gone. Here is your opportunity, and you don't take advantage of it. I wonder if that just accelerated the breakup machinations because of just how dispiriting that is.
So here would be kind of a counter-argument to the Pelicans or Hornets or whoever they are in 2008. Great team, right? I love that team. I mean, Chris Paul, you have David West and Tyson Chandler and LaPage and Bo Peter on the wing.
Fun team,
great group of guys. And I mean, one could argue, and by the way, like, got to a noble second round exit, right? And so a less charitable person, and this is not my position, but I can argue it. Yeah, Chris, it's easy to go out bowling when, you know, you have the world's most mature power forward and David West, just an inconsummate, I mean, team guy, probably the most thoughtful guys who's been in this league the last 15 years. And you know, you can have your centers who catch lobs and Peja and Mo Peter, just kind of exemplary wings who will defer to a brilliant point guard. That's the easy part. The hard part is we're learning in this league, and, you know, and Kawhi and Paul George are going to have to do it this year, and AD is going to have to learn to do it, is generally speaking, unless you're Kawhi Leonard, 1 year Toronto, that's the easy part. The hard part is sort of sharing. The hard part is sort of cooperating with a guy of commensurate, if not greater, raw talent, and deferring to him, even if you're smarter, or you believe you're smarter. And I don't know who's smarter, James Harden or Chris Paul. And I think that, yeah, it's always easy when it's Mo Pete and David West and Tyson Chandler, right? That's the easy part of being. That is the recipe to perpetual second-round conference semifinals bow out nobly as a 2 or 3 seed every season. But if you want to be, you just have to sublimate certain instincts that you just hold dear, which is, I know how to do this better than you. Which I think is the subtext, and often it is, you know, that's a great line from The Wire, you know, sometimes McNulty was the smartest guy in the room. Look at the guys he had patrol with, right? Like, there's a reason he acts like that, because he is smarter than everybody else. And I think that's sort of the thing, you know, he comes into Houston, and you probably the same stories I have, right? Which is like, you know, sort of kind of, you know, lecturing everybody on how the defense should be run, and this is how they did it with the Clippers. Well, it was the Clippers was sort of the response of everybody who was there, who was incredulous over his intransigence initially, sort of adapting to the defensive schemes. It's not like he came from this world-beating, you know, defensive juggernaut in Los Angeles, and yet, you know, Chris knew better. It's hard. I mean, I don't want to charge him that. I'm with your colleagues or the people you know in the league who think he's one of the three best of all time. I think Chris Paul might go down as the greatest point guard of all time. And I know that is just, but I say that apart from the other part of the criteria, which I don't know how to factor in. I mean, how do you factor in stubbornness or the fact that, you know, your team is just 20 to 40% less happy and excited to come to work or be on the floor together than they otherwise would be, because you have certain traits that might make it difficult. And I don't know how to judge. And again, I don't know how much of that is impacted losing. There are plenty of guys who are difficult to play with who have won championships. I mean, I don't know. This is what always shakes me as a person who tries to be data-driven and whatever, and I've learned to sort of compromise for these cultural considerations. Like, I don't know. I would be ridiculous to tell you that's why he hasn't gotten to a finals. I think that would be ridiculous, but I also know that it exists. And I also know it's one of the reasons he's in Oklahoma City right now, rather than playing again to be the team that can, you know, fill the vacuum that the Warriors left. I don't know, but it's real. And I don't know where you consider it in the entire equation of the question you're asking.
I don't know that there's any way I can put him above Magic Johnson or Steph Curry once it gets to the end and we're talking about who are the best point guards ever. I just don't see any way with what those guys accomplished statistically, and Steph is still going in year 11 or whatever next season, year 12, or I think it was 2009 draft, and the 8 combined championships and counting for Steph maybe. I just don't think that there's any way Chris Paul can rank above those guys. And then you get into a different kinds of conversations about all the other point guards. The last thing I'll say on Chris is one of the other things that makes him incredibly difficult to evaluate. Whether you care or not, he is one of the greatest plus minus players of all time. And I'm not talking about, I'm talking specifically about, his team's scoring margin with him on the floor, and even perhaps more pertinent, the comparison between that figure and his team's scoring margin when he's on the bench. The difference between those two figures, one generally positive when he's on the floor, one generally negative when he's off the floor, has been absolutely gargantuan. I had the league a couple of months ago. I don't remember whose season I was interested in. I think I was interested in LeBron's season from 2009 when he was just unbelievable. And the Cavs were 23 points better per 100 possessions with Bron on the floor. I was like, that's gotta be the best figure ever for guys who get to a minimum of minutes. So I had them look up this figure dating back to 2007-08, which is as long as they can go. The two best such figures of all time are Draymond Green and Steph Curry from the 73 win season. Chris Paul has 3 of the 10 highest single season figures in that time period and 4 of the 18 highest single season figures. He and Curry are half of the top 20. And, you can read lots of things into that. You can read, like, I remember, and you still hear this. I remember you heard when LeBron was in Cleveland, why is their team so bad when he's on the bench, even if Kyrie and Love are both in the game? And people around the team would say, well, it's because we have no offense. Our offense is LeBron. And when LeBron goes off the floor, no one has any idea what the hell we're supposed to do. We have no system. We have no play. We don't do anything. And maybe some of that is baked into Chris Paul's teams. Maybe Chris Paul is the offense to such a degree when there is no Chris Paul, you're just kind of freewheeling it with mediocre players and you stink. But those numbers are what they are. And they're historically great. And, you know, you got to reckon with them. If you're going to dismiss Chris Paul as overrated, as a fraud, as a locker room lawyer, as a backstabber, whatever the hell you want, as a postseason failure, well, but you got to reckon with those numbers. Anyway, let's move on. I'm sick of talking about Chris Paul because, you know what? He's only 34. He just turned 34. He may be on a good team at some, either in Oklahoma City or somewhere else this year. So let's give him time. There were two teams that I told you I wanted to talk about. That in the midst of this free agency frenzy and everyone's, you know, obsessed with what happened in LA and Brooklyn and the, you know, Utah and the West is loaded and the continuity Denver gets to enjoy. And well, Portland is one player away from being super duper interesting if they aren't already. And the Warriors, how good are the Warriors going to be? I wanted to talk about two sort of like, I called them dormant sleeping giants or something in emails with you. Franchises in the West that just kind of have been forgotten about or just kind of left by the wayside that fancy themselves as in position to get back in the conversation for like interesting team. And one of them, the first one we'll talk about is one of the sort of flagship franchises of the league, I think, a big city franchise, a franchise that wants to be a free agent destination but hasn't been, and that's the Dallas Mavericks. No one's talked about Dallas because they came into the offseason with the potential to get a lot of cap space that they did not end up using. Instead, they stayed over the cap and they signed Seth Curry for the mid-level exception or thereabouts. Maxi Kleba, re-signed. DeLon Wright signed and traded into the Harrison Barnes trade exception. Extend Dwight Powell at about 11 a year. And of course they will get Kristaps Porzingis back from injury to play alongside Luka Doncic to acquire Kristaps Porzingis. They traded two first round picks and took on bad New York Knicks salary, and Dennis Smith Jr. went out the door too. So that's their team. None of those names are sexy. You could argue that none of those names are starter quality players in the NBA. Kleba, Wright, Curry, Powell. Maybe you disagree with that. They're capped out this summer. A year from now, two summers from now,
hard cap, right?
Well, I'm talking about just like a year from now when free agency starts again. They're on pace to have no cap space really. Two summers from now, when the whole league is going to have a crazy free agency again, they are, as things stand now, short of max cap space. But of course, as you said earlier, this summer showed us if you have good players and draft assets, you can make magic happen even if you don't have cap space. Now, some of their draft assets are out the door already, so be that as it may, and they would. I think, you know, they have two really good players. What else do they have? But I'm just interested, like, I don't know what the Vegas over-under on these guys is yet, but they've just, it's been so long since we talked about the Mavericks as anything but what in the hell happened to the 2011 champions? Why did they dismantle that team and chase free agents and whiff on all of them? Do they even know that the NBA draft exists as a way to acquire talent? Or if they just decided it's not for them, other than when they get to get Luka Doncic? Like, do they know that it's happening? Like, does Donnie Nelson get a calendar reminder like, oh, today's the draft, let's assemble the war room and trade our pick or trade down or trade out or whatever? No one's talked about them other than like Dirk's retirement tour and what happened to the title teams. And yeah, Rick Carlisle's a great coach, and every year, like, J.J. Barea and Devin Harris are involved, and they somehow scrounge up 38 wins and play zone and do crazy stuff. And, oh, there's Salah Medjri coming in and blocking some shots, and boy, why doesn't he play more? What do you make of this team? Are they good? Are they going to be good? What do you make of their signings? I just want to talk about Dallas.
They're one of those interesting teams where I kind of like everything they did individually, and in the aggregate, and I'm not sure it gets them in the top seven. I sort of have seven teams that I regard as teams in the West where literally if they do get bounced in the first round, it will represent a huge disappointment, right? The two LA teams, Houston, Golden State, Denver, Portland, Utah. Like, that's sort of my I think if you told every of those teams, guess what, you're going to bow out in the first round right now, they'd be really upset.
And guess what?
Perhaps Dallas would be, too.
Guess what? Three of them are not getting best
right.
first round.
Three of those seven are not going to be playing conference semifinal series. So it's hard for me. So it's one of those things. Do I like the Seth Curry signing? Yeah, it's a great number for Seth Curry, right? Like, this is one of those, you kind of go down and say, oh, DeLon Wright? Yeah, you can stay on the floor and stay healthy. Like, that's a good number for DeLon Wright. And yet, you know, when you start looking at it in the aggregate, is it, okay, I mean, to me, the variable, and I don't think I'm breaking any kind of news here, but is Luka Doncic, given the amount of experience he's had at high-level basketball, like, could he make literally sort of the Giannis season 4 jump this season? You know, is that in the cards? I mean, are we talking about, like, could we be talking in March about the fact that Luka, hey, I might have him on my ballot, you know, as the number 5 MVP vote? That's a stretch, but to me, the margin of their success is going to be, that's the elasticity. I mean, I kind of know what Seth Curry is. I kind of know what DeLon Wright is. We don't really know what Kristaps is yet, obviously, and his health. But, like, to me, the elasticity of your expectation for the Dallas Mavericks is on this question. Is Luka Doncic by March going to be one of the 10 to 12 best players in basketball? And if the answer is yes, that's an interesting conversation. But that's kind of what I think of the Dallas. It was a year ago, they drafted a guy who has a chance to be an absolute generational beast. And when he arrives as such, we will be talking about them in different terms. And all this rest of this stuff is nice table setting. And at some point, you know, Tim Hardaway will come off the books, the sooner the better. But until then, that's to me, that's the measure of everything with Dallas right now, is that guy. We've learned nothing this summer other than this is a superstar league. And the minute that guy graduates to he is here, then we're having that conversation.
And some of that, I think, is going to be, you know, when the Hawks traded out of the opportunity to draft Luka Doncic, when the Kings, who are the other team I want to talk about, passed on the opportunity to draft Luka Doncic, part of the reasoning in both cases was, I think, well, you know, he's really good. He's going to win Rookie of the Year. He's going to be a top 40 NBA player the moment he walks in the door. Genius passer. Good shooter. Ballsy. Wants it in crunch time. We just think he's pretty close to his ceiling. And if his ceiling is 4-time All-Star, like, yeah, I'll take Trae Young and an extra bite at the apple over that. Now, if we're wrong and his ceiling is 10-time All-Star, then we're really wrong. And I'm very curious. He completely exceeded the hype in year one. People still think that about his ceiling. I think that is prematurely putting a ceiling on what is still a very young player, specifically because they've got to get him in shape. And once they get it, if they, like you talked about Giannis, like, no one's in better shape than that dude. Like, I want to see, what is the difference? Now, maybe it doesn't happen this year, but what is the difference when he gets in, like, Miami Heat shape? What is it? What does Luka Doncic look like when he's like, okay, I'm going all in on my body and my diet and my nightlife and all this, and, like, I'm really coming at you, and all of a sudden I'm lighter and more muscular and this and that. Like, that's a different player. One of the reasons I'm intrigued by them is they have a two-man pairing of young guys that, if they both hit and stay healthy, makes a lot of sense. And is complimentary and is still cheap enough in terms of, like, Luka Doncic is on his rookie deal for 3 more seasons. Porzingis is on the 25% max, not the 35% max. It's not that hard to add a third guy to that core. Now, you can talk about you've already got your lead ball handler and your lead big man. So is the third guy a shooting wing? And how many shooting wings are there that are, like, third guys like a Bradley Beal or, you know, Klay Thompson? I don't think that's ever going to happen. But, you know, somehow, some way, they get a third guy. They get very interesting. But I agree with you. I kind of like what they did. Like, I think DeLon Wright's really good. And if he can make enough catch and shoot threes, and he's a below average 3-point shooter, but a little better on catch and shoot threes, he's sort of like your Pat Beverly-ish I don't know if he'll ever shoot it as well as Pat has the last couple of years, but you're, you know, the guy you want to have next to your wing who's a, your de facto point guard, like the guy who defends point guards really well and makes catch and shoot threes and can run the offense while you rest a little bit. Like, that's a nice fit. I like Dorian Finney-Smith for the price they got him at. Like, he's got a little bit of maybe 3-and-D potential, maybe. I kind of like their team. I don't think they're a playoff team next year, but, you know, it, maybe it's, They ended up staying over the cap instead of using $30 million plus in cap space. They still have $11 million of this trade exception left. Maybe they can do something else. Like, it's not – it's so in a way, it's another summer of they have all this cap flexibility and they don't have a star or anything super-duper exciting to show for it. But I think because they've been out of the limelight for so long, I think they're really interesting. I'm excited to see how they play next year, and I'm and they have a certain ability – They have other directions they can go if that two-man game with Doncic and Porzingis is real. I think they're back as like a team that makes some sense and is worth talking about.
Yeah, I think you kind of just hit on it, which I was about to say is there are multiple routes they can go here, right? I mean, their guaranteed number going forward leaves them. Again, whether it is they can get their hands on a shooting guard, whether it is they decide, actually, you know what? Luka's a guy with a ball in his hands, but he's not a point guard. We need someone who's – let's go get Chris Paul. I think that they've left themselves multiple routes, and their scenario planning is pretty clean going forward. They can do a lot of different things, and they've got a lot of value contracts. And that's, like, a good thing for a team in that position.
All those contracts are going to be movable, including Powell – at 11 a year or whatever it is. Powell's pretty good now. He is one of these players who every year there's like seven players who, when it's March 15th and half the league is not trying, all of a sudden Dwight Powell's scoring 20 every night and making threes again. And you're like, is this real or is this just like NBA April basketball? But like, he's pretty good. I'm interested to see how much he plays with Porzingis, how much Porzingis plays with other big men who sort of duplicate some of what he does. Like, that's obviously one of these, like, is he a 4 or a 5 questions that we're all going to say, duh, he's a 5, but is he going to actually play the 5? That's all stuff that's going to be resolved, but all those contracts are movable. Seth Curry's good, Kleba's good, like, all those are movable. I almost think maybe they dodged a bullet is too strong. I never really got their obsession with signing Kemba for the max. And I kind of wonder if they're going to be better off long term with all these shorter, smaller contracts than with age 29 Kemba at the 30% max going forward. Who doesn't need the ball because he's a good shooter, but he's a ball handler. That's what Kemba Walker is. He's a pick and roll ball handler, and so is Doncic. And yes, they could cooperate and there would be synergy between them, just like there would have been synergy between De'Aaron Fox and Luka in Sacramento. But like, they really coveted Kemba and they didn't get him. And I kind of think, as much as I like Kemba, that they might be better off.
Blessing. And I don't say that as a knock on Kemba. I say that as a belief that their timetable is different. And again, when I start listing those seven teams, I think this is the better. There will be 29-year-old point guards who will be overvalued in year 3 and 4 on the market every single summer. You can always get that done. When the time, and by the way, there are times in the life cycle of the team where doing that, i.e. the Boston Celtics, makes a lot of sense. I just don't think the 4-year deal for the 29-year-old small point guard who may or may not age gracefully is just not a Dallas Maverick play right now. I think it's an absolute blessing. I was thrilled to see them not make that deal. And not that Kemba would have embarrassed them. Kemba's great. But, like, it just doesn't, in terms of their timetable and their trajectory, I just never liked it and didn't really understand it other than this, you know, thirst the franchise has had to be back in the, on the good list of teams that guys go to in free agency, right? I mean, I do think a lot of that is sort of persona and image. And hey, you don't pay income tax. You know, like we're just as big a market as Houston. And I just think that, like, going away from that and doing it the way they're doing it, I much prefer it without. I'm with you on that.
Let's do one more team, and that's the Kings. The Kings, sleeping giant is a little much for the Kings. They're sort of like a sleeping sloth. What's something incompetent, like a sleeping jester? I don't know. They're sleeping. They have not made the playoffs since 2006, which is really a long time ago. It's hard in the NBA to go 13 straight seasons or 12 straight seasons or wherever we are without making the playoffs. They did win 30, and I say, like, they didn't get a lot of attention in the offseason because of all the other muckety-muck that happened. But they won 39 games last year. They have fairly naked ambitions of being a playoff team as soon as possible. And they had a pretty active summer. Trevor Ariza for 2 years at $25 million, I believe, second-year partial guarantee. Corey Joseph, 3 years, 39, which is a horrendous overpay, but the third year is only, I think, $2.4 million guaranteed. Deadman, 3 years, 43. Last year is only $1 million guaranteed. Harrison Barnes did the I'm opting out, wink, 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 I have a done deal, 4 for $84 million, whatever it was. That's a lot of money for Harrison Barnes. A lot of money. We can talk about that. And then, you know, like, the bill is coming due pretty fast. Buddy Hield is up for an extension now. He's going to get a lot of money. And you start adding up all the high draft picks they've had, like Bagley already makes a lot of money. Harrison Barnes just got paid. All those other guys just got paid. Buddy Hield will end up getting paid. De'Aaron Fox sure as hell seems like a guy. If Jamal Murray gets the max right out of the gate at the earliest point possible, you better believe De'Aaron Fox is coming in a year from now and being like, where's my max? Give me my max. And at that point, this is your team. Now, you can say that you have optionality because of those non-guaranteed years in year three and year four of Deadman and Corey Joseph and, you know, all those deals. Maybe they're movable. Maybe they're not. Maybe you just don't have cap flexibility. Like, even I did the math. Even if you did in the summer of 2021, even if you just kept the cap holds for Fox and Harry Giles, you don't extend them. You just keep their cap holds. Even at that, plus the non-guaranteed, the only this tiny guaranteed portions of Deadman and Corey Joseph, you still don't have like a ton of room. You got like 15 or something. I don't have it in front of me anymore. You don't have much. Like, they're pretty close to, and but this doesn't include Bogdanovich, who's a very good player, who's a free agent after next year. I'm very interested to see how this team works on the floor, which we can talk about. And if it doesn't work as well as they hope in 2 and 3 years, what is their pivot point? Give me your Kings thoughts.
I mean, this is one of those, I don't love, unlike Dallas, where I look at the deals. I don't love any of these deals individually. I don't know that I hate them collectively, because I mean, let's say that for the next year, the cap space is irrelevant, right?
Like, yeah, who cares?
It
doesn't matter.
A team like Sacramento does have to sort of, I don't say irrelevant. I mean, you can always say.
Well, the free agency class a year from now stinks. Like, you could really argue, Buddy Hield could walk into their office and argue somewhat plausibly, like Caris LeVert will Pascal Siakam will. Like, I'm the best free agent in the class. Literally the best.
And they will have to pay him accordingly. And I think ownership will pay him accordingly. But I just, you know, Dwayne Dedman, to me, the appeal of Dwayne Dedman was you get a really competent basketball player at a very good price. At well above the mid-level, I don't like it as much for a position that I think is a mercenary position. I just think help as a big, you know, particularly if you believe in Giles and his health, and I really like Giles, particularly if you believe, as I do, that Marvin Bagley is probably a five, certainly in the modern game in the West, and certainly needs to learn to be a five, given that he's a number two pick. I just don't quite understand the commitment. When there are other kind of lower price bigs out there, Barnes is tough for me. I understand they're not a destination. I understand that this is the way that often business has to get done in that market. I also understand it's a number that's just shy of being gaudy, but man, it's still, as you point out, going into the summer of 21 and 22, when you know you're going to have Hield and De'Aaron Fox at big numbers, when you know Bagley's going to be a year away from getting extended or paid, it's just an enormous cost and to incur when you might actually have need. And I think Trevor Ariza could have been the triage, getting you through one, maybe two seasons. And I don't know.
I don't mind Trevor Ariza.
I don't mind that one at all. I just, but there's just, it's not even a redundancy. I just don't. I'm trying to see where Barnes fits in all this. Not just because they didn't, by the way, play their best basketball after he arrived. I wonder if Barnes is somewhat of a, I wouldn't say empty calories, but certainly the sum is always less than the individual components of the game.
What is the emptiest calorie food? White bread? Like what are, what can, like,
yeah, wonderful.
Like pretzels? We need something
white potato, by the way, like white potatoes.
We need to find the food that is the emptiest calories, because I'm tired of saying empty calories.
And we'll call it the Zach Levine. Yeah,
like you're the salty pretzels. Like you're giving me
pretzels.
Nothing.
Actually, I have this note. I know this from like looking up press room food that I should and should not eat on a given night. Is pretzels actually okay? I mean, relatively speaking, if you're going to carb up
a bagel,
and you've got like
is
that
it a bagel
of like press room like Lay's potato chip, like a Staples Center spread. You're better off going with the little skinny pretzels. I think pretzels. Now, I'm not talking about the Philadelphia pretzel. I'm talking about that's actually a relatively, if you're gonna cheat, that's not a bad place to go.
I gotta find this out.
Isn't this much more interesting than Harrison Barnes?
I cut out all of those snacky things because I was a little heavy and I needed to lose weight, and I have lost like 20 pounds. And I discovered the revolutionary diet of just eat less food. That's my only.
I call it the don't be an idiot diet. The Clippers are notorious. I think all the great dangers in NBA pressures, you know that. You're probably like me. I don't like keep a lot of crap in the house. I just don't because I'll eat it. But press rooms are the death of you. And the Clippers kind of lead the league in sheet cakes for no apparent reason on a Tuesday night. You know what I mean? And bless their hearts, the Clippers this goes way back with the Clippers, and they lead the league in just great crap sitting in the middle of those 10 top round tables. And it Halloween is all year. And it's just, and
here's
I, so I think
here's,
like,
a,
ba- I, in
here's a basket of stale tortilla chips for some reason. Like, no dips, just a bunch of tortillas.
And they got a huge toppings bar with the soft serve. And it's that to me. So I did the same thing in 2018. I actually was you know what? I don't eat in this room anymore. I just don't. I bring in, I have the depressing little Tupperware from home where I have cut up strawberries or something. And it actually is kind of, I lost 10 pounds in the 18-19 season. This year it was a little touch and go.
I cut down bread, and I cut down your pretzel type snack genre of food. And it turns out like that works. That actually works. Eating less. My exercise regimen has not changed at all. My imbibing regimen has not changed at all. I literally just eat less food. I should write a scam diet book about this. Just everything, all these self-help things, I'll just make up my own diet. Eat less food. Just we should start our search firm. I'm serious.
And
Windhorst should start our search firm because these things are just scams. When the next team has to hire their GM, we'll just undercut the whole market. We'll start Arnovitz Low Windhorst search firm. Pay us an enormous amount of money, but less than you're paying whatever other search firm there is. I'll give you the names of 10 assistant GMs that appear on Google frequently, and I've done my job. And you get to blame your bad hire.
And love booking, and with Windhorst and me, we love nothing more than making travel arrangements. So that's actually half the job, is sort of the logistics, so that the office doesn't have to be scheduling 6 interviews with 3 minority owners and everything else, right? I mean, part of what these firms do is just offer logistical support. And I present to you no two better human beings in the world to get assistant GM to city for interview, or neutral site interview wherever the owner is spending his summer in Sun Valley or wherever, than Windhorst and I can.
This
do
is
that.
My
we,
plan.
We would master it.
When the robots take over media and there are no jobs left, this is I don't have a better plan than this. This is it. This scam search firm. Maybe we'll just call it scam search firm.
Yeah, turnkey. We're coming for you, man.
Yeah,
we're coming for you. So yeah, the Sacramento Kings.
I know we've already gotten lost in
it.
What you're saying about Harrison Barnes is, if Marvin Bagley is a 4. And Harrison Barnes is a 4, and Harry Giles is a 5, and Dwayne Dedman's a 5. They're going to have to make a decision at some point. Is Bagley a center? And if Bagley's not a center, then he's slightly positionally redundant with someone you just paid $20 million a year. Or you just need the Bagley-Giles front line to be the thing that works. And maybe they had stretches last year where they showed enough combined perimeter skill as teenagers or whatever they were, 20-year-olds, that you looked around and said, man, that's interesting. Like, if Bagley can start shooting threes and Giles can get a mid-ranger, they pass, they cut, you know, for 20.
I love that front court. I really do.
It looks like the apex of modern basketball is not small ball. It's skill ball with size. And, like, that looked like you saw the outlines of what Vlade envisions when he talks about Fox and Giles and Bagley as the young core of their team. And, by the way, he still thinks Bagley can play the threesome. He said that on the record to me. I was polite. I was like, oh, that's interesting, Vlade. Okay, really? Three? Okay.
That's because, like, Vlade's the single most pleasant person to, like, have a conversation with in the NBA. But the problem with big men executives is they think like big men. And that's sort of, like that's the thing you end up spending. And, again, like, I say this, one of the genius parts of Dwayne Dedman is he's a guy you don't have to pay $13.9 million to in year three, right? Like, that's the whole point of Dwayne Dedman, is you bring this guy in, he gives you plus minutes, he's a good defender, he works his tail off, and you get him for a price. Like, that's the whole point. The appeal of Dwayne Dedman is you don't have to sign him for $13 million a year over 3 years. You don't have to give that guy $40 million guaranteed.
How sick of Willie Cauley-Stein must they have been to be like, oh, we can get Willie Cauley-Stein for, like, literally no one is giving him any money. We'd rather have Dwayne Dedman for six times the price.
And it's just not a good allocation of resources at a time, again, where I present to you the seven teams that are probably better than you. Now, look, they can make some crazy jump, and there's a lot of competence on that roster. I also don't love paying, you know, as Corey Joseph. Another guy I really like. The genius of Corey Joseph is you probably don't have to pay him that money.
Well,
I
like their team, and I really enjoyed writing about them at the end of last season. It was to round out the conversation. It, like, when I started diving into them and watching them play, and I was at a few of their games and interviewing their coaches and players, it's like, man, it feels nice to just kind of write a basketball story. Like, here's a team that can be together for a while. Let's see how they fit on the court. What are the puzzles that have to be solved on the court? What is it? It was like,
let me ask you a question about them in that respect. I trade Buddy Hield for this reason. I think he is absolutely at the top of his value. He was so ridiculously good. They won more games last year with Buddy slinging, and in a way that you're like, that doesn't seem completely sustainable, especially given that he's older than you think, in terms of, like, he came out as a 23-year-old. I mean, how old is Buddy at this point? 28?
Well, that
already
changed. That changed about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, it was that as well, right? So I wonder, and also I happen to be a Bogdanovich guy. I just love the player.
He's going to be the cost of doing business. If they re-sign all these guys to the point you're making, he's gone. Like, they're just not going to be able to keep him.
Oh, by the way, you needed Dwayne Dedman. I forgot. We forgot about Rashawn Holmes. Like,
good player.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think it. How many bigs do you need? And this is, again, big men who are executives always need more bigs. But with Buddy, I'm just wondering. He's on such a great value right now. He has been fantastic. I just think, talk about a guy in a position of need in the league. Like, I wonder, what could you get for Buddy Hield?
Imagine if Dallas had anything else left to trade, and
exactly,
he was the shooter that we were talking about before next to Luka and KP? Boy, oh boy, that's a problem.
You know, but at any rate, yeah, I watched more Kings basketball than they were my top three last year. First of all, I love Grant and Doug. I love that crew, and so it's just fun. And like, they're both, I would say, like, what you want in your league pass broadcast crew is you want them to be objective but not neutral. I mean, you want to believe they want the team to win, but they're, you know, they're also not like homers who are yelling at the referees the entire night, which is just obnoxious. But I watched so much Kings basketball last year. That was my preferred 10:30 team or 7:30 team. And they're going to be a hell of a lot of fun again to watch this year.
Well,
I
will say, you know, about the it being a basketball story and a team that can stay together. They, like, the team I kept thinking about in relation to them was the Nuggets. And then when I interviewed Dave Yeager, who of course has since been fired because the Kings just fire people, he mentioned how we actually kind of think about the Nuggets a lot too, and what we can become, and the power of youth and continuity. The Nuggets became a team with a real future, not just a cute, like, hey, maybe 50 wins one year future, when Jokic became a top 10 player and an MVP candidate. And so the Kings are going to have to look at this roster and saying, who is our Jokic? And they think it's Fox or Bagley. They think Bagley has that kind of potential to be a top 15 or whatever player. I don't know. We'll see. He's so raw. So here's my question to you. This will be my last Kings point. I don't like to put people on the spot like this, so I'm going to do it anyway. Pick one for the next 8 years. De'Aaron Fox or Jason Tatum?
De'Aaron Fox.
I like it. Because it gets back to the Chris Paul issue of, can the point guard be your best guy? And if not, and like, Tatum is the classic antidote to that. He's the classic, like, well, that guy who's 6'8 and can score from all over the floor, that's a championship alpha dog. Now, the sheen has worn off after last season on Tatum, but I think he's going to have a very good year this year. Fox was better than him last year. And I think that's a really interesting question. Like, who is the guy on their team who's going to be in that conversation for top 10 player? Because if it's nobody, I'm not sure that they get there's just a ceiling you hit as a team.
By the way, I really like Jason Tatum. You know, I mean, I just there's something I'm kind of in the tank for Fox. I love the possession control. I think he's got the length to really defend really well when he decides he wants to. And he will soon, because he's going to realize how beneficial it is to be a really good defender to winning basketball games. And the Kings are just going to need that. Particularly if they are kind of a smaller outfit, particularly Bagley is the five. It's just like the top of the floor is going to be more important. And I really like Jason Tatum, but I just think there's something about De'Aaron, and I don't like saying things like intangibles, because you should be able to measure it and certainly describe it, but it is a lightning bug energy. He pressures the defense on every possession when he is in control, and he's just learning to be in control. I think there is a ridiculous trajectory there. That's why I'm very bullish on them. Which is why, like, I count on that guy. I don't need the other. You're spending too much on peripherals here, and they don't need to be spending that money on that personnel right now.
He was the reason why I wanted to write about the Kings, because it was very clear by the middle of last season, maybe even earlier, maybe November, December. There was a game against the Cavs that I watched, wherever that was, it just hammered it home, that Fox had graduated from, you know, when you're that athletic and that fast, you can be a step behind the game in terms of your absorption of what's happening and still win possessions on pure talent. And then usually you catch up to the game. And so you're processing it at the same level of the vet, at the same speed and level as the veterans, and then your talent can really shine. Then you graduate to, I see it better. I see it faster than three quarters of the players on the floor. Or I can manipulate the back line of defense. He went all the way there in half a season, and I don't know what's next, but that was super duper exciting.
To be able to dictate the terms of play is just, I mean, in terms of play. And I don't know that I buy this, the point guard can't be the best. I don't know that I necessarily buy it, especially since we're told that it can't be a big man or a four or five anymore. So, I mean, you know, unless we're saying that, like, this only happens with wings, and maybe that's the case. LeBron, Kawhi, you know. But I just think his ability to dictate the terms of possessions at whatever pace, in whatever sequence of events he wants to exact on the floor at a given moment, is so extreme and cool to watch. And I will be watching more Kings basketball this season.
I can't wait to watch them next season. I think they're a super interesting team going forward. I'm really, you know, as much fun as we've all made at the Kings over these last 13 seasons, like, it was magic when they were good out there. It was, I mean, part of the reason, a lot of the reason was the style that they played. But that fan base is ready. That's a fun team. And if they really join this playoff race next year, if they're a legitimate candidate for one of those last two playoff spots in the West, you know, that's awesome. That'll be a lot of fun. So here's hoping that that's the case. Mr. Arnovitz, have a wonderful summer. I will see you on the other side of this NBA offseason, and we'll talk about what everything looks like next season. But thanks for another year of wonderful podcasting and chit-chatting and all of that. And again, great work, and thanks for everything, my friend. I'll see you on the other side.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.